Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Years ago, I took a little day trip with some friends to a place called the Book Barn in Niantic, Connecticut. And one of the things I came home with was a book called Mourning Dove, a Salishan autobiography. And that book has been sitting on my desk as a potential episode inspiration since then. If not directly on the desk, like adjacent to the desk, it has been next to me. And according to the receipt still stuck in that book, that trip happened in 2016. So that gives an indication of how long it can take to go from like a potential podcast idea to a podcast episode. Mourning Dove was an activist, an ethnographer, and a novelist, and one of the first, if not the first, Indigenous women in the United States to publish a novel. She was known by a lot of names. One was Christine Quintasket, and at various points, she also signed letters as Crystal, Christina, and Catherine. She was married twice, and during those marriages, she also used each of her husband's surnames. As an adult, she usually used the last name Quintasket at home among the Confederated tribes of the Colville Reservation, but she usually used one of her husband's surnames with outsiders, whichever marriage was in existence at that point. She wrote under the name Mourning Dove, which was sometimes printed along with the name Humishuma, which is sort of an approximated English spelling of the insulation word for mourning dove. That is the Salish language that she grew up speaking. And then she was also given other names in that language at different points in her life. And these were really names that she used within her community and not with the wider public. And really, there's not one right name for her. She was raised in a culture in which people have and use different names in different contexts and for different times in their lives. We will mostly call her Christine Quintasket or Mourning Dove, since that's what was on her published work.
Christine Quintasket gave the year of her birth as 1888, although there are other years from the mid to late 1880s noted in various government and school records. She was the oldest of 7 children, born to Joseph Quintasket, who was Okanagan, and Lucy Stukin, who was Colville. These are 2 of the 12 bands that are part of the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation, which is federally recognized as one tribe today. The name comes from Fort Colville, which was named after Hudson's Bay Company Governor Andrew Colville, and members of the tribe voted to keep this name in 2018.
Although 12 bands compose the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation today, historically, there were more than 50 living in this part of North America. The area includes land that's now described as Canada's Interior Plateau and the Columbia Plateau in the United States. These people spoke a number of different languages and dialects, most of them in the interior Salish language group. And while many of these are still living languages and are spoken and taught today, the entire Salish language group is considered to be critically endangered.
As we just said, this plateau is in both the U.S. and Canada, so the establishment of these two nations created an international border through this ancestral homeland. Unlike many of the other reservations that we've talked about on the show before, the Colville Reservation on the U.S. side of the border was not established through a treaty between these indigenous peoples and the United States. It was established by an executive order by President Ulysses S. Grant on April 9, 1872.
F.A. Walker, Commissioner of Indian Affairs, had written a letter the day before outlining the need for a reservation for 8 named tribes as well as, quote, scattering bands who were not party to a treaty with the United States. Acting Secretary of the Interior B.R. Cohen forwarded this to Grant, and the executive order simply read, quote, "It is hereby ordered that the tract of country referred to in the within letter of the Acting Secretary of the Interior and designated upon the accompanying map be set apart for the bands of Indians in Washington Territory named in communication of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, dated the 8th instant, and for other such Indians as the Department of the Interior may see fit to locate thereon."
But less than 2 months later, on July 2nd, Grant issued another order, restoring that land to the public domain and designating different land for the reservation instead. This new piece of land was described as, quote, "the country bounded on the east and south by the Columbia River, on the west by the Okanagan River, and on the north by the British possessions." The British possessions, of course, being Canada.
This new reservation was a lot smaller than the previous one had been. It was about 2.8 million acres of land. And for comparison, these tribes' territories had historically covered about 39 million acres of land. And then from there, the reservation got progressively smaller. In 1887, Congress passed the Dawes Act, also known as the General Allotment Act. Previously, reservation land had been held by tribes collectively, and there are some nuances about who was legally considered to be holding the land, but the overall idea was that it belonged to the tribe as a group. The Dawes Act allowed for that land to instead be divided up and allotted to individual members of the tribe.
This was ostensibly to protect indigenous people's land rights, but in practice it did the opposite. People who were allotted land were expected to assimilate with white culture and to do things with it like farm it using European methods. But in many cases, the land itself really wasn't conducive to being used in this way, and even if it was, people were expected to give up their traditional culture and practices in order to receive it. The law also called for supposedly extra land that was not allotted to anyone to be sold to non-Indigenous people. And a lot of the Indigenous people who were allotted land wound up losing it for all kinds of reasons. This was devastating and destructive to Indigenous peoples and their communities.
Starting in the 1880s, mining companies also started trying to get access to the mineral-rich northern part of the Colville Reservation. A federal delegation was dispatched to the reservation to negotiate an agreement with the tribes, and that was signed on May 9, 1891. The tribes agreed to cede roughly 1.5 million acres of land to the federal government in exchange for $1.5 million. The tribes also successfully negotiated to keep the right to hunt, fish, and gather on the land that was being ceded. However, while Congress passed an act removing everything from Township 34 north to the Canadian border from the reservation in 1892, Congress did not start passing legislation to actually pay the $1.5 million until 1907. And then that 1907 legislation did not appropriate the entire amount. Congress appropriated $300,000 a year for 5 years until 1911.
Indigenous people also faced hostility and legal action for hunting and fishing on what had been the North half, in spite of having retained those rights in the negotiations. This led to the U.S. Supreme Court case Antoine versus Washington in 1975, in which an indigenous couple had been convicted of violating Washington hunting law on land that had been part of the north half of the reservation. In that case, the court upheld the indigenous nation's hunting and fishing rights.
This loss of land and the emphasis on farming were both devastating to the bands and tribes who are part of this community. Traditionally, these peoples had moved according to the season, so fishing for salmon and hunting, gathering things like roots and berries from the forests in a pattern that is sometimes described as the seasonal round. To be clear, there is not just one seasonal round. The specifics really vary, even within the same region and from one community to another. Farming was a totally different way of life from this. And again, a lot of the land that was part of the Colville Reservation wasn't really usable as farmland.
And the loss of the north half affected Mourning Dove's family directly. People who had been allotted land on the north half lost those allotments, and the Quintasket's family's land allotments had been there.
We will get to Mourning Dove's life after a sponsor break.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. As we said before, Christine Quintasket, or Mourning Dove, was born around 1888 and was the first of her parents' 7 children. In her own story about her birth, her family was traveling with a group in what's now northern Idaho, and they didn't want to stop, even as her mother, Lucy, went into labor. So Christine was born in a canoe as they crossed the Kootenai River and was wrapped in the shirt of one of the men who was paddling the canoe. And her family later attributed kind of a tomboyish streak to the fact that her first piece of clothing had been a man's shirt.
She and her siblings grew up primarily near Kettle Falls, Washington, but also experienced some of the seasonal hunting and gathering that we talked about before the break. Christine first learned to read from a white orphan named Jimmy Ryan, who was adopted into the family. And she learned a lot of her cultural and traditional heritage from a woman named Tikalt. Tikalt had also been welcomed into the family after Christine had found her alone and disoriented, saying that she was going to walk until she died. Mourning Dove described Tikalt as another grandmother.
Christine's mother wanted her to have this indigenous education and to learn the traditions of her people. It was really important to her. And at the same time, Lucy Quintasket was devoutly Catholic. She thought her daughter, Christine, also needed to get a formal Western-style education and Catholic religious training to help her survive in a world that was increasingly dominated by white people and the U.S. government. So, in 1894, Christine was sent to the Sacred Heart School at Goodwin Catholic Mission in Ward, Washington, not far from Kettle Falls. Christine was already familiar with this mission before going to school there. It was where the family went to church when services weren't being held at the mission that was closer to their home. Even though the school really wasn't far away from where her family lived, she was a boarding student there.
We have talked about schools like this in a few previous episodes of the show. Christian missionaries and other religious organizations were establishing schools to Christianize indigenous children as early as the 17th century. Congress passed the Civilization Fund Act in 1819, which provided government funding for these schools. Later, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, boarding schools were established to physically remove indigenous students from their families, languages, and cultures. Schools like Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania and Fort Shaw Indian School in Montana, both of which we have talked about in prior episodes. This grew to a whole system of institutions that included more than 400 federal boarding schools and more than 1,000 federal and non-federal institutions, including day schools, sanitariums, and orphanages.
The boarding schools and day schools had the same basic purpose, to civilize, in quotation marks, indigenous children and force them to assimilate with white Christian culture. These schools were built near the end of centuries of active warfare between the United States and indigenous nations, but they were another way to try to eliminate the indigenous population. General Richard Henry Pratt, superintendent of Carlisle Indian Industrial School, summed it up as, quote, "kill the Indian in him and save the man." At boarding schools and day schools, indigenous children weren't allowed to speak their own language or wear their own style of dress. They were forced to speak English and wear European-style clothing.
There were people involved in these schools who were motivated by a charitable or humanitarian impulse. They thought that they were helping these children. But this whole mindset was racist and genocidal. And there were also people involved with running these schools who were not altruistic at all. Children faced widespread abuse and deprivation, and it is likely that thousands or even tens of thousands of children died at these schools. And this was also interconnected with federal policies meant to break up reservations, abolish tribal governments, and take over indigenous lands. It was all part of the attempt to eliminate the indigenous population of the United States.
Yeah, when we say it's likely that thousands or tens of thousands of children died, there is no question about the fact that many, many children died. Like, the possibility there is that the actual concrete number is not known. The U.S. made attendance at these schools compulsory in 1891, with the Commissioner of Indian Affairs empowered to enforce this law. Federal policy toward indigenous nations had been so destabilizing and violent that there were children who basically had nowhere else to go. There were also cases in which federal officials used children as hostages, especially the children of indigenous leaders, so placing children in schools far from their families to try to keep their parents compliant. At the same time, there were also families like Christine's who believed that going to one of these schools would help their children survive in a rapidly changing world. She described Father DeRouge, a Jesuit priest who told her mother that she should be sent to school, as somebody that the people of the Colville Reservation respected.
When Christine Quintasket started at Goodwin Catholic Mission School, she only spoke the interior Salish language of Insiirchun, or Colville, Okanagan, and she was punished for not speaking English. In his introduction to a reprinting of one of her books, editor Jay Miller points out an added layer to all of this. She was being punished for not speaking English by nuns whose first language was French. Eventually, she became too ill to finish the school year.
Christine returned to school in 1897, and she described her experience that time as less traumatic than her first period at the school had been. When the school closed down in 1899, she went to the government boarding school on the Fort Spokane Agency. She stayed there for about a year, and then her mother died in 1902 when she was about 14. After her mother's death, she stayed home and she helped take care of her younger siblings until her father remarried in 1904 to a woman named Cecilia.
At that point, Christine went to Fort Shaw Indian School in Montana, where she stayed for 3 years and worked as a teacher's aide. She was able to come and go from the school, at least to an extent, and visit a grandmother who lived nearby. We have a lot more about Fort Shaw Indian School in our two-parter on the Fort Shaw Indian School girls basketball team that came out in 2017, and it also has more detail about the boarding school system.
In 1908, while in Montana, Christine saw the roundup of some of the last free-ranging bison in the United States. Prior to the arrival of Europeans, there had been an estimated 30 million bison, also called buffalo, in North America. Today, bison are associated primarily with the Great Plains and the West, but they lived on much of the continent. But by the early 19th century, their population was in sharp decline. The word overhunting does not go nearly far enough to describe why. This was an intentional slaughter carried out by both federal troops and private hunters, meant to deprive indigenous peoples of a critical source of food. By the late 1880s, bison were nearly extinct in North America, aside from a few small herds that were mostly on private ranches.
One free-ranging herd that remained had been developed largely by two men, Charles A. Allard and Michelle Pablo, who bought some orphaned bison calves from an indigenous hunter known as Sam Walking Coyote. Allard and Pablo each had an indigenous mother and had grazing rights on the Flathead Indian Reservation, which is home to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. By the time Allard died after a fall from a horse in 1896, the herd had grown to about 300, and by 1906, there were 700.
By that point, Pablo was concerned about the safety of the herd because more and more homesteaders were moving into the area where they ranged. He initially tried to sell the herd to the U.S. government, which refused to buy them, so he sold them to Canada instead. He shipped about 500 bison to Alberta's Buffalo Park between 1908 and 1910. So the roundup that Christine saw was part of the process of gathering up the bison to send them to Canada.
Seeing this had a huge impact on Christine Quintasket. Buffalo had played such a key part in the cultures and lifeways of indigenous peoples all over North America and had been intentionally hunted nearly to extinction as an act of genocide. Now she was seeing some of the few that remained on the range terrified and struggling as they were rounded up to be taken somewhere far away.
This would also become one of the inspirations for her novel, which we will get to after a sponsor break.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. In 1909, Christine Quintasket started working on a novel. That same year, she married Hector McLeod, who she had met at Fort Shaw Indian School. This marriage seems to have been turbulent. McLeod could be violent and spent a lot of time around bootleggers, one of whom reportedly shot off one of his hands. They also struggled financially. We mentioned earlier that the land that had been allotted from the Colville Reservation often wasn't good for farming. So rather than farming their own land, a lot of indigenous people in the region wound up as wage laborers doing agricultural work for other people on other land that was more farmable. This included Christine and her husband, who worked as migrant agricultural laborers around the Pacific Northwest.
There are accounts of her life that make this sound almost like the romanticized life of a struggling artist, that she would work in the fields and orchards during the day and write in a tent at night. But the reality was that this work was exhausting and it took most of the daylight hours. She mostly wrote when she wasn't doing agricultural work.
By 1912, she was estranged from her husband and living in Portland, Oregon. She started using the name Mourning Dove on her work, at that point spelled M-O-R-N-I-N-G, like the coming of the day. She wanted to write in English. Specifically, she wanted to write about her own culture and people for an English-speaking audience. The novel that she was working on was a Western romance, and it was one that she thought would humanize Indigenous people for white readers. She was also collecting Indigenous stories. But since she grew up speaking a Salish language and her English classes had been kind of spread across 8 years at three different boarding schools, she still struggled with various aspects of English. So from 1913 to 1915, she moved to Calgary, Alberta to attend Calgary College Business School. She studied things like typing, shorthand, and bookkeeping while also working on her English.
In 1915, she attended the Frontier Days Festival in Walla Walla, Washington, where she met Lucullus Virgil McWhorter. McWhorter had been born in Virginia in 1860 and had become a rancher after moving west in 1903. He had also become an advocate for the rights of Indigenous people and communities and had been adopted into the Yakima Nation after helping them fight for their land and water rights. He had been given Indigenous names that translated to Old Wolf and Bigfoot.
A mutual friend named J.W. Langdon later encouraged Mourning Dove to reach out to McWhorter for some help with her writing. Mourning Dove had almost finished a draft of the novel that would eventually be published under the name Kogiwia. But at first, she and McWhorter talked about the notes that she had collected on 22 indigenous stories and legends. They had both seen the effects of the federal government's destructive policies on indigenous communities, and they both thought that if these stories were not intentionally preserved in writing, they would be lost. McWhorter thought that Mourning Dove was an ideal person to do this, so he encouraged her, maybe even pressured her, to record the knowledge and culture of her people. He started out acting essentially as her editor and literary agent, but over time, they developed a working relationship and a friendship that lasted for the rest of Mourning Dove's life.
This relationship was complex. McWhorter was more than 20 years older than Mourning Dove, and he was a man and he was white. So there were some clear power disparities involved. He made additions and changes to her novel that we're going to talk about more in part two, sometimes without talking to her about those changes. And once the two of them did start to talk about working on a novel, he started arranging interviews and a speaking tour for her. Mourning Dove would eventually become known for her speaking, but initially she found this prospect terrifying. She was really worried about her ability to speak English well in front of an audience and what their response to her would be. She eventually got sick and the tour was indefinitely postponed.
By 1916, they were ready to find a publisher, and Mourning Dove wrote a letter to their mutual friend J.P. McLean about the finished draft of the book, saying, quote, "We both worked hard on it, and we sometimes almost went on the warpath, but we always patched up a piece and continued friends. He helped me with Kogiwia, but next time I am going to let him make the plot, and I will help him."
In 1916, she did an interview with a Spokane newspaper about what McWhorter thought was her soon-to-be-published novel. This ran in the Spokesman Review on April 9th, and it was reprinted 2 days later, and it was picked up by other newspapers all over the country, including the Washington Post. This article covered about the top third of a page, and it featured a full-length picture of her in indigenous dress and a smaller one with, quote, "her hair done up on her head and wearing garments of her white sisters."
This article illustrates so much about Mourning Dove and about the presumably white writer's attitudes about her and about indigenous people. It describes her as, quote, "as Indian wealth goes, wealthy," because she had leased some land she had been allotted to white farmers. She definitely was not wealthy in any way that involved money, though. As we said earlier, she was often working as an agricultural laborer to try to make ends meet. The writer's description of her is both flattering and infantilizing. Like, she's described as a, quote, "stout-hearted Indian girl." But if she was born in 1888, she would have been 28 when this article came out. It also describes her as speaking faultless English, quote, "as is usually the case with those to whom the tongue did not come naturally, but who have been diligent students." A later part of the article also describes the color of her skin and eyes, as well as her weight.
Much of the article is ostensibly in Mourning Dove's own words, beginning, quote, "the white man does not know the Indian. He thinks the Indian cold, emotionless, pitiless. He is not. You think the Indian does not cry, does not love, does not kiss. Before you, I might not cry or show my emotion. I would never faint. But alone, if my heart was sad, I would weep, and like a white woman, find comfort and relief in tears." She was pushing back on the stereotype that indigenous people were stoic, and the idea of using her writing to dispel stereotypes about indigenous people would be an ongoing theme in her work and in this article.
She also talked about how hard it was to spend so much time indoors at a typewriter. It just was not what she was used to. She also described missing her community's sweat lodge and went on to describe what that was, comparing it to a Turkish bath that a white person would pay to use. This was one of several times that she sort of tried to build a bridge between her own culture and that of white readers, and to use ideas that she thought those readers would understand.
In this article, Mourning Dove also described civilization as bringing both good and bad to her people, with one example being an increase in divorce, which had previously been almost unheard of. And she described her tribe as continuing to change. For example, her stepmother would speak to her children in her language, and they would understand but answer in English. She also said that her stepmother had given land from her allotment to build a school, one that was now attended by her children, with all the rest of the pupils being white.
This article ends with a passage about Mourning Dove's experience at the Buffalo Roundup that we mentioned earlier, although this reporter places it as at 5 years previously, which would have been in 1911. She again returned to the idea of the depth of feeling of Indigenous people, contrary to this stereotype of their being stoic and emotionless. Quote, "One magnificent fellow fought like a lion as they tried to crowd his wonderful shaggy head into a boxcar. In some way, he broke through the barriers on the opposite door of the car, fell down between the trains, and broke his neck. Cry? I saw some old, wrinkled, dried-up Indians sob like babies. It is wrong, this saying that Indians do not feel as deeply as whites. We do feel, and by, some of us are going to be able to make our feelings appreciated, and then will the true Indian character be revealed."
As we said earlier, this article was meant as publicity for her book. The headline describes that book as soon to be published, but its publication was not soon at all. 11 years would pass between this article and Kogawea coming into print, and we'll get to that next time.
Yeah, I think usually when we do two-part episodes, I say at the beginning that it's going to be two parts, and I don't think I said this time, so
surprise,
it's a two-parter. Because, you know, in addition to her life being really fascinating to me, there's a lot of context we want to make sure we want to include with this one. I have listener mail.
Fantastic.
Before we close out, this is from Lauren. Lauren wrote after our Unearthed installment recently, saying, "Hello, Holly and Tracy. I've listened to the podcast since shortly after becoming a stay-at-home parent in 2012. I've wanted to write to you, and the perfect opportunity presented while listening to Unearthed in Autumn 2023, Part 1. When you mentioned the study about the atlatl as an equalizer and spear-throwing skill, my ears perked up. The Friday before the episode was released, my two kiddos, husband, and I had paid a visit to my alma mater, Kent State University, to visit the anthropology department. My son has an interest in tool making, and the director of the anthropology department just happens to study karate at the same dojo as my kids. I mentioned this interest to her, and she arranged a visit to the experimental anthropology lab at KSU. Dr. Beber and her colleague, Dr. Aaron, showed us around the lab, did a stone tool making demonstration, explained Dr. Beber's research, and we even got to use atlatls to throw spears. Needless to say, it was amazing. Dr. Beber is wonderful and does amazing research. I was starstruck having had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to hang out with two leading scientists in the experimental anthropology field. Then imagine my excitement as I heard Dr. Beber's research mentioned on the podcast. It was the coolest thing ever. I know they've been featured on History Channel shows, etc., but hearing you talk about research I had just personally had explained by the researcher was the most exciting thing ever. Thanks a million for putting so much time and effort into the podcast. It's truly wonderful and a highlight of my day. Best, Lauren. P.S. I've attached pics of my two standard collies. Matilda, Tilly, is the fluffy girl, and Clementine, Clem, is the smooth-coated girl. Let's look at these collies.
They're so pretty. Goodness.
Collies are so beautiful. When I was a child, a family that we knew had a miniature collie, and I wanted one. So even though from the moment I could say the word cat, I have been a cat person, for whatever reason, collie, I was like, yes. That, of course, was a slightly different collie than these adorable collies, because that was a miniature collie. And these are standard collies. But thank you so much, Lauren, for this email and for these pictures. If you'd like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. We are also all over social media at Missing History. That's where you'll find our Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram. I said Twitter and it's not called that anymore.
I still call it Twitter.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do.
I refuse.
If you'd like to subscribe to our show and you haven't yet, we're on the iHeartRadio app and wherever else you like to get your podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.